be able to recognize the main difference between Al-Ghadir and Al-Saqifa, and as a result, the true successor to the Prophet of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en-islam-page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they've been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain? South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase "the U.S. losing its superpower status" continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, "We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with." It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis including two children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. The weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the US, UK, Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staffed by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nisour Square massacre. The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, after a truce, has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, in which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel, and Western entities, would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his high-ranking diplomatic and economic delegation has visited Uzbekistan on an official visit. The aim of the visit was to expand bilateral ties with Uzbekistan. Iran and Uzbekistan signed a total of 17 memoranda of understanding that the two countries would boost their cooperation in the fields of trade, cargo transit, cultural exchanges, health and custom issues, among others. Another important aim of President Raisi's trip was Iran's further integration into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has held signing a memorandum of commitments to join the SCO. The announcement was made by Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying the delegation on the visit to the city of Samarkand, which is hosting a summit of the SCO. It means that Tehran has now entered a new stage of diverse economic, commercial, transit, energy, and other cooperation with the member states of the regional body. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was founded by China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in 2001.
Whereas Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about exactly what it says. I mean, it's about countries cooperating in the sphere of economic issues, but also security. And I mean, if we look, what are the benefits for Iran? Well, I mean, there are a number of benefits within the sphere of economics and security. Hard security. Because, I mean, Iran has been subjected to decades now of economic coercion and threat of military action by a US unipolar world, which has been using its institutions to coerce and squeeze Iran.
It's currently the world's biggest regional market, with 8 official members and 3 observer states. Iran and the organization started a formal process for Tehran's accession to the bloc in March. Its membership was later approved by the Iranian administration. Despite the U.S.-led efforts to isolate Iran over the past decades, Tehran's diplomatic weight in regional bodies is now growing. Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will give it economic and political room to further integrate into the non-Western-led bloc.
This is a possibility for Iran to develop cooperation in such things as economic matters with other countries in the non-Western world. I mean, this is equally true for the large countries such as Russia or China, where, such an arrangement, it's beneficial for everyone. It's a reciprocal exchange. It's not a one-way exchange. And so I think in this regard, Iran, with its location and with its resources, is a very useful addition.
Iran has also applied to join BRICS, a group consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This forum represents 40% of the world's population and 26% of the world's economy. Ultimately, BRICS could become a club of the world's largest energy producers and consumers outside the United States. Iran holds the world's second largest gas reserve, and its membership in BRICS would result in added value for both sides. Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to U.S. attempts to isolate Iran. It's believed that Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its role in the BRICS Plus economic mechanism have both made Iran a partner in international macro decision-making and in the political, security, and economic fields.
What happens here, it provides possibilities to create meaningful cooperative relationships with countries of the non-Western order. And this is the order that is rising. We can see lately too, Iran has not been the only one under pressure, but India as well for its independent position on Ukraine. So, these Western institutions are just absolutely part of their foreign policy agenda, which is to maintain U.S. hegemony at all costs.
It will also elevate the position of the multilateralist front in the international calculations. Tehran, for a long time, has called for the pro-multilateralism front to establish and promote independent financial, economic, political, and cultural mechanisms in order to make a smooth transition from the current unilateral U.S.-led world order to a multilateral one.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the innate of seeking justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having the innate of seeking justice, of fitrah, of seeking justice. We see that it is inside the mankind that mankind is striving for the justice, and it wants justice, it seeks justice. And wherever we see oppression, wherever we see a sin, wherever we see someone is taking the rights of others away, we start speaking out, we start shouting out, and we start to protest against such actions. And this protest, this feeling that we have, which we feel bad about the things, and through this feeling we judge people, this judgment is all based on our innate, because whoever does not observe justice, we don't like that person. We straightforward say or have a feeling in ourselves that this person is not right because he's taking over the rights of the others. He is oppressing others. We have many examples. For example, there were protests around the world when we had the incident of George Floyd, when the Yemeni children are bombarded by the Saudi Arabia, the people are shouting out, they're protesting. The things that are happening in Palestine, we can see that there are many things, many other examples which we see in our society or locally. We can see many examples around us, and we feel bad about this. Why do we feel bad? It's because it's in our inside, it's in our innate, that is telling us that this is not justice, it is oppression, it is injustice. And therefore, we feel bad or we protest against such actions. And this is what we say, that the innate is seeking justice. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of innate seeking justice. And we said that it's in our innate, it's in our fitrat, it's in our nature that we seek justice. And therefore, we see that from the signs of the intellectual or intellect is that al-amalu bi-sunnati al-adl. It is said that we need to observe the justice, we need to practice justice. And therefore, we see that Allah Tabatabai, even when he talks about the justice to be the part of innate, he discusses that, he says that the justice is equal to goodness. And the justice must have goodness in it. And if it is not having a goodness in it, then obviously this is not a justice. It is something else. And we know that the goodness itself is something which ourselves like it. We like to be good. We like goodness. We like to be dealt good by the people. And because we like all these things, this goodness, therefore we are inclined towards the goodness. And we are being, we can say, attracted towards the goodness. And whenever we are attracted towards the goodness, it means that there is something good in it. And the justice itself is something that whenever somebody observes the justice, the people, they like it. They praise the person. And even if it is against some people, but because he dealt with them with the justice, they even admire it. So therefore, this goodness, because it is being observed by the people, people like it, and people want the goodness, and we know that the goodness is part of justice. Therefore, justice is also something which is inside us, and we are inclined towards this justice and towards the goodness, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. The American people are still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. We have prepared for you an article written by Gene Marks. The piece is titled, U.S. Inflation Isn't Going Away, Small businesses must plan ahead. According to a report recently issued by the U.S. National Federation of Independent Businesses, inflation is the top challenge facing small businesses this year, with a whopping 91% admitting that rising prices are having either a substantial or a moderate impact on their companies. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that nearly 7 in 10 small businesses have raised prices to cope with inflation, which is also considered their dominating challenge. 65% of small business respondents in a Goldman Sachs study said rising input costs have forced them to raise the price of their goods and services this year, with almost 80% saying the economy has gotten worse over the past 3 months. U.S. officials claim if Americans are having inflationary challenges in their business, they're not alone. However, they say there is some good news for them. And, unfortunately, some bad news as well. The good news is that inflation appears to be plateauing. They claim prices for core materials such as industrial chemicals, construction supplies, copper, aluminium, plastics, packaging, iron and steel, and even agriculture products like fertilizer and processed feeds are either leveling off or not rising quickly. The price of lumber products has dropped significantly from their highs last year. Oil prices are down 30% from earlier this summer. But this is partly because the world's supply chain is beginning to show signs of normalcy. Port traffic in Long Beach, California is down to 84 ships off the coast, significantly less than during the pandemic. Mass lockdowns in China have ended, and the Baltic Dry Index, a key measure of freight costs and shipping demand, has fallen almost 30% since the beginning of the year. There's also been a general slowdown in the world's demand for goods, which, while not great, has certainly affected prices. It's doubtful whether the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, regardless of the positive impact it should have on our climate and healthcare problems, will have much impact on inflation. Penn's Wharton School says that the bill would actually increase inflation until 2024 and has low confidence that the legislation will have any impact on inflation. But officials claim the good news is that government spending has significantly decreased and the U.S. Federal Reserve is no longer pouring fuel under fire. This brings me to the bad news. We're still struggling with rising costs and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. Producer prices at 11.3% as of June are still up well over historical levels. And because the Producer Price Index is considered a leading indicator, that means that ultimately consumer prices will remain at elevated levels for months to come. It took a year and a half for inflation to reach these levels. Consumer prices began rising in March 2021 and hit 7% by the end of 2021, well before Russia's special operation in Ukraine. It's going to take at least that long for it to return to the more sustainable levels we've seen in the past. It may take even longer. That's because there are lots of obstacles in the way of significantly taming inflation. Some economists, notably former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, believed the Federal Reserve's moves aren't aggressive enough. Thank you. Further pressure from the Ukraine conflict could elevate energy and food prices, particularly as we head into the winter months. More COVID cases in China could once again disrupt the supply chain. Even if the world economy begins to grow significantly again in the near future, that growth could put strains on U.S. fragile supply chains and disrupt pricing for many of the core materials Americans buy. What is clear is that when and if prices do start to fall, it is going to take time, and in some sectors, a lot more time than in others. Nor is declining overall inflation a guarantee that prices will not rise in some areas again. The energy sector, particularly gasoline prices, have played a huge role in soaring inflation rates. Compared to last year, energy prices were up 41% in June, and gas prices alone were up 60%. According to federal government statistics, Americans are using less gas this summer. Gas consumption in the United States is now over 1 million barrels a day, below levels that were seen in the summer of 2020, which was already lower than what was seen pre-pandemic. Despite falling demand, it is still unclear how long the low gas prices will last. The energy market is extremely volatile. Some analysts have warned that gas prices could go up again in the fall as stricter sanctions against Russian oil are set to start in December. The OPEC cartel of oil-producing nations agreed to an increase in oil output that is seemingly in a snub to Joe Biden, their smallest increase ever. Like the energy market, the food sector is highly volatile as well, as it is also sensitive to geopolitical relations and climate. The food index increased 10.9% over the last year, the largest 12-month increase since the period ending May of 1979. A number of factors went into the rising food prices, including a highly infectious avian flu that wiped out many chickens across the country. Tyson Foods, one of the largest meat producers in America, said that labor shortages and higher grain prices played a role in rising meat prices. The pandemic induced a shortage of semiconductor chips, which are used in everything from phones to television sets to cars, that is still being seen today. The shortage is squeezing the car industry. Analysts are predicting that the low number of new car sales, which dropped 12% year over year in July, will continue throughout to the end of summer as the supply of cars continues to be sparse. According to Cox Automotive, the average price for a new car hit a record $48,000 in June. In July, Americans were paying 10.4% more for new vehicles and 6.6% more for used cars compared with the year before. That's a dramatic fall from earlier this year. In January, used cars were 44.6% higher than they were at the start of 2021. But it still means prices are rising, and from a high base. Though the chip shortage does not affect the used car market directly, fewer new cars means that people are holding on to their cars rather than buying new ones. The Senate just passed a bipartisan bill that provides $52 billion in subsidies to chip manufacturers in the United States, an investment into developing a more robust domestic chip industry, though any impact from the bill on the car industry will not be seen for some time. Though used car prices showed signs of easing earlier in the summer, they still remain historically high and will probably remain so for the near future. Economists argue that it is possible that inflation has hit its peak, and there are signs that many of the pressure behind inflation are easing, but it is still hard to predict the path that inflation will take. Some of the prices being seen today, like for gas and homes, will probably continue to go down, but other costs will, in the best-case scenario, stay put. the process of turning inflation is unpleasant. Fewer people can afford to buy houses or new cars, and businesses have less money to expand. But getting inflation down is necessary for the economy to get back to a healthy balance between supply and demand.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. When the president returned from his trip abroad, he immediately went to Kirman to visit those who have been affected by the floods. His minister also spent several days monitoring the work that was being done. These are important matters. This is one of your accomplishments. It shows the administration's empathy towards people and their presence on the field to get the job done. This is an accomplishment. I'm not mentioning these accomplishments just to praise you. What I'm trying to say is that you shouldn't give up on this kind of work. Make sure you don't stop doing this. Keep it up.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another accomplishment you've made is that you've removed all negative competition from the relations between the three powers, executive, judicial, and legislative systems. I believe this is an important matter. It is bad for the government, the parliament, and the judicial to constantly clash with each other and complain. Such actions worry people. Today we feel there is agreement and that a kind of empathy exists. Of course, this part and this work is one of the things that both the government and the parliament must take care of and maintain. It is a fragile matter. This is one of the things that is not really in your control or in the parliament's control. Certain individuals may come and create commotion and create sedition among you. You need to try and preserve this empathy and consensus. The government, the parliament, and the judiciary all need to be mindful of this. You need to be careful. Another of your achievements has been your employing the youth in the country's executive sectors. This is a great move, for it opens the worn-out circle of managers, replacing them with a new force.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has paid tribute to Queen Elizabeth II on the eve of her state funeral on Sunday, saying Britain and the world has been lucky to have her as a monarch for more than 70 years. Stay with us as we look at the world media's coverage of this event. Britain's Guardian newspaper has covered this story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss's planned meeting with Joe Biden at No. 10 Downing Street, which was to be her first major diplomatic event as Prime Minister, has been rescheduled for Wednesday at the United Nations in New York. Officials from both countries said that a meeting in the margins of the United Nations General Assembly would allow fuller bilateral discussion and was not the result of friction between London and Washington. But whenever the two leaders meet, they face disagreements over Northern Ireland. We have been in constant touch with Downing Street and have both decided that it is preferable to hold a full bilateral meeting in New York on Wednesday, a Biden administration official confirmed. However, policy considerations on Northern Ireland is a major irritant in US-UK relationship. The Northern Ireland Protocol is an agreement with the European Union after Brexit, by which there are custom checks on goods transported from the British mainland to Northern Ireland, thus allowing the border between North and South to remain open and frictionless, a vital element of the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement. The Biden administration has already warned that any unilateral steps to undo the Northern Ireland Protocol would not be conducive to US-Britain trade deal. And President Biden, who is proud of his Irish roots, is expected to make clear his personal commitment to defending the Good Friday Agreement and urge Liz Truss to keep negotiating with Brussels. Folks here are watching and they care, a senior US official said. Liz Truss continues to say she wants a negotiated agreement, so let's do it. Arguing that the Northern Ireland Protocol is too much of a burden on British business, Liz Truss has proposed to unilaterally negate parts of the agreement and is contemplating invoking Article 16, which allows a party to the agreement to suspend part or all of the protocol if it causes serious economic, societal, or environmental difficulties. The Northern Ireland Protocol was also discussed in Liz Truss's talks on Sunday, 18th of September, with the Irish Taoiseach, Michael Martin, part of a hastily arranged diplomatic round, as representatives from almost all of the world's 195 countries attended Queen Elizabeth II's funeral, which will take place on Monday in London. Liz Truss also hosted the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and New Zealand's leader Jacinda Ardern at Chevening, her official residence in Kent. The Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is not expected to come to London to convey Riyadh's condolences. It is unclear whether that is due to Buckingham Palace's fear of negative publicity or Mohammed bin Salman's reluctance to take part in an event in which he would not be accorded front-row status, albeit with other leaders. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same issue from a different angle. US President Joe Biden paid tribute to Queen Elizabeth II on the eve of her state funeral on Sunday, saying Britain and the world had been lucky to have her as monarch for more than 70 years. Biden, among scores of dignitaries from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Americas who have arrived in London for Monday's funeral, said the Queen's death at 96 years of age had left a giant hole on the global stage. "To all the people of England and all people in the United Kingdom, our hearts go out to you," Joe Biden said, after signing a book of condolence. He said he had consoled the Queen's heir, King Charles III, that the Queen would be with him every step of the way, every minute, every moment, and that's a reassuring notion. Hundreds of thousands of people have descended on London to bid farewell to Britain's longest-reigning monarch. Joe Biden followed other world leaders in appearing on a balcony overlooking the coffin in the historic Westminster Hall. French President Emmanuel Macron also appeared on the balcony. The US President later joined King Charles III and other leaders for an evening reception ahead of the state funeral, which is on Monday. Biden was one of 14 U.S. presidents in office during Queen Elizabeth II's reign, of which Elizabeth met all except Lyndon B. Johnson, starting with Harry Truman in 1951, when she was still a princess. French President Emmanuel Macron was seen walking near the River Thames earlier on Sunday, 18th of September, mingling with those who had gathered in the streets around the British Parliament. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, however, is no longer expected to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral in London, according to British government sources. Inviting the man, Western leaders believe ordered the murder in 2018 of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi had been very controversial. Britain has not held a state funeral on the scale planned for Queen Elizabeth II since that for the World War II leader Winston Churchill in 1965.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carber was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organizers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increased during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the holy city.
Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Iranians across the country have commemorated Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. People in the capital, Tehran, marked the occasion too by walking southward to the town of Frey. That was a symbolic walk by those who could not take part in the Arba'in march held in Iraq, where pilgrims from across the world marched toward the city of Karbala, which houses the holy shrine of Imam Hussein.
I'm so sad that I couldn't visit the holy shrine of Imam Hussein this year, but I took part in this walk in Tehran to play my part in preserving the legacy of Imam Hussein.
This is a march for all of the freedom seekers, no matter what their religion is. Imam Hussein sacrificed his